Hi, everyone. Lisa, alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa. Hi, everybody. Tracy, alcoholic.
So I've never done a big book workshop before, so I'm really nervous. You nervous?
Very.
You know, normally, I'll share my experience, strength, and hope in a meeting, but, you know, I said, how hard could it be, right? You know, I'm just telling you how I went through the steps, how I take women through the steps, and so Tracy and I decided to start with the doctor's opinion and basically share a little bit about ourselves through, you know, reading this. I'm sober almost 4 years, God willing. My sobriety date is 12/16/18. I have a sponsor, Becca, and she has a sponsor, and I have two home groups. One is the Westfield group on Monday nights at 7:30, and also Mountainside at 7:30 on Thursdays. So I hope we bring you a great message, and I'm so grateful to Tracy because she kind of, I was kind of left to do this by myself, and I was like, I was so nervous, because it's always good to have somebody to bounce off on. And so Tracy agreed to do this with me, so I'm forever grateful to you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Hey, everybody, Tracy, alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 31st, 2010. My sponsor is also Becca. My home groups, I have two, is the Friday night 7 o'clock meeting right here and the Thursday night Mountainside group of Alcoholics Anonymous, 7:30 Thursday night. As I said, Becca is also my sponsor. And I sponsor other women, and I'm equally as nervous. I've never done this before, and I was telling these guys, you know, right before I came, I used to, when I first got sober, and this meeting was in the small room over here on Sundays, I used to come and I used to sit in the back, and I would be in awe of the people sitting up front, and I'd just be like hanging on every word. So it's an honor to sit up here and share a message with you. So shall I?
You shall.
Okay. So as Lisa said, we kind of just wanted to bring as much of the 12 steps as we could in 4 weeks. And one of my favorite chapters in the beginning is the doctor's opinion. I can remember when I was really close to admitting that I was an alcoholic, but I just wasn't there yet. I knew I was drinking too much, and I was at a doctor's office and here in Westfield, actually. Had never been there before, and I started to get honest for the first time. And it was the first time that a doctor said to me that my liver enzymes didn't look good, and that's when I started to tell them about my drinking. I did nothing about it. I never went back to that doctor again, but I had had experiences with physicians, with my husband and with myself, where they kind of just said, you know, you're drunk. You know, and when I read this chapter, it really, really spoke to me. And you know, like Lisa was saying, she felt better about having somebody else here with her because this is a we program. And I love how the doctor's opinion starts. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. And this book is a text for recovery. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. I'm going to jump around. I'm not going to read the whole thing. And in the course of his third treatment, he's describing Bill Wilson. He acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. No longer suffering from a hopeless state of mind and body. And I remember reading this and thinking, you know, could this really be so? Could I really do this? Could these people really help me? I was so afraid to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard that, it's a cult. It's all about God. It's this, it's that. And I got to a place where, I had no other choices. I needed help. So I thought, this says right here, must do likewise with still others. That means that these people are doing it with other people. They're doing it together. I know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. And let me tell you, every other method that I had tried failed completely. I tried, to drink other things. I was a Southern Comfort drinker. I tried to drink just beer, just wine, just vodka. I always went back to my drink of choice and then some. I still have a book in my house. It was a diet for people who were trying to quit drinking. And it just, every time I come across it, it just cracks me up. So I kind of leave it there just for, humor's sake. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. This is a shift. And these men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. So tonight, and I was always told that I can only share my own experience, and I circled themselves because I can only share with you what I've got, nothing that I don't have. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D. So the physician who, at our request, gave us this letter had been kind enough to enlarge his views in another statement. Here he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. And here is step one, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It didn't satisfy us to be told that we couldn't control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, we were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. And we're sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. And to me, when I first read this, I was like, huh? What does that mean? What does that mean? So then I'm looking at what step one is. Am I powerless over alcohol? Has my life become unmanageable? And in getting prepared to sit here before you tonight, I was looking back at some and listening to some Joe and Charlie tapes, because when I got sober, I loved listening to them. And one of the things that they had said about steps 1, 2, and 3 is that they're not action steps. They're just, they're questions. Are you powerless over alcohol? Is your life unmanageable? And people always ask, all right, so what do I do for step one? How do I work it? You just kind of answer the question, with all the honesty that you can muster inside of you. But one of my sponsors did give me an assignment when we went through step one. And she said to me, and I still have it, and I give it to my sponsees today. Am I really willing to go to any lengths to have this removed? Where have I been dishonest with myself and with others? What do powerlessness and unmanageability really mean to me, and how are they different? And I was like, oh, God, I don't know. And, I wanted to get the right answer. But there is no right answer. It's whatever it is for you. For me, Powerlessness was unable to have any control. And unmanageability was not able to manage anything that I did have control over. So, you know, I had control over certain things in my life that I could make decisions about, but I wasn't making good decisions. I wasn't thinking things through. I was powerless over alcohol because I knew I couldn't drink safely, and I couldn't keep from drinking. And that's how I knew I was powerless. You know, I couldn't have just one. And when I did have one, it always led to more, and I had no idea where I was going to end up. And at some point, it just led me to sit in my house and not go anywhere because of the destruction that I would cause. Okay. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. The phenomenon of craving, though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it's imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. You know, there have been many instances or opportunities that I've had to do a 12-step call. And it is always better to plant a seed when somebody is done, at least for the day. You know, tomorrow they may not still be sober, but it's always better that they hear your message. Because when they're still drinking or drunk, they're not hearing you, you know. And at the end of the day, when they are sober, if a seed has been planted and they do want it, your hand is always there. My hand is always there. But if they don't want it, that's okay. I've planted a seed. So he goes on to explain how alcoholics help other alcoholics, and that how the doctor could not bring about any sort of change in the alcoholic with the powers that they had on a scientific level. But he had watched how Bill Wilson had worked with other alcoholics and other alcoholics working with other alcoholics and how they came to change. And he asked to tell his story to other patients, and there were some misgivings about that, but they consented. And the cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves, and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. I think that's a very powerful, powerful paragraph. And a beautiful thing, you know. And I get to see that here. Maybe not every day, but it's a wonderful thing to watch, you know, my own sponsee or Lisa's sponsee or somebody else just start to change. You know, you just start to see that different person emerging from when they first got sober. It's almost like a flower starting to bloom. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit, such as detox. We believe and also suggest that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So we're different, you know. When we drink, we have a different result than you know, the average person or the average bear. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all or anything mind-altering. And once having formed the habit and found they can't break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That's unmanageability. You know, having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, we are beyond human aid. We have to rely on a power greater than ourselves, whatever you choose to call it. I choose to call it God. When I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I relied upon the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my higher power, because I didn't know where I stood with a higher power at all. And that was okay. And I was told it was okay. You know, I was scared to admit that to anybody, like, oh my God, I don't have a God, or I don't have a higher power. You know, everybody else is talking about it, and I wanted to fit in with everybody else. And my sponsor told me, that's okay, as long as you believe in something for now. You know, just keep coming. And that's what I did. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices, like your family begging you to quit. I can remember my mother-in-law begging me to quit. It did nothing. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholics' appeal must have depth and weight. It's got to mean something to us, you know. And for me, for this alcoholic, the only thing that held that depth and weight was somebody else who was an alcoholic, who was sober, who had been there, who shared their story with me, who got vulnerable with me. And that was the only thing that held any depth and weight with me, and still today. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives, because we can't do this alone. I'm going to skip to the bottom of the page. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can gain experience in the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. No punishment, nothing. And this was totally me. I couldn't see my life as being anything else. And everything was this big, you know. A problem today that's like this, I saw like this. It was drama central. It was on, you know. We had to do something about it. It was a crazy, crazy lifestyle, and it was the only one I knew. And I didn't think that getting sober was going to change that. I thought I was still going to have a crazy life. And that is living in delusion, not just about alcohol, but about everything. Everything I believed, everything I thought was a delusional thought or a delusional feeling. Because feelings are not facts.
That's the first thing she's ever said to me.
The phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of esprit, emerging remorseful and with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. You know, some people experience a psychic change. Some have what is called the educational variety. I believe mine was of the educational variety. I didn't see white lights, nothing of that sort. What I did see was a change in me. I started to see things that were always right in front of me, but I had a totally different perception of them. I took it in differently. I reacted differently to it, if that makes any sense. Once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems, he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules, not suggestions. And they're referring to the steps and asking for help. Those are recovery experiences. You know, the thoughts of delusions, those are alcoholic experiences. These are recovery experiences. Skipping down to, although he gives all that is in him, it is not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. That is God or your higher power. I can remember about 8 years ago, 9 years ago, I was about 3 years sober. I had worked the steps a few times, thought I knew a thing or two, but I was in such a funk. And I was at a meeting up at the Italian Club in Summit. I don't know if I was speaking or I just shared at the meeting, but this woman came up to me after the meeting. I had shared how I was just miserable. I didn't understand why. Like, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. And she said, "Honey, you need God." And I kind of wrote her off, you know, as a fanatic. And then I was like, you know, she might have something here, you know. I don't have to adopt her God. I know that, you know, but I might need to look at that. I have to tell you, it didn't last that long. The being miserable. I just started to make friends with my higher power, so to speak. And it felt really silly, and it felt really stupid, but it worked, and it helped, and it still does today. So you know what? I don't care if it's silly. I don't care if it's stupid. I'm going to keep doing it until it doesn't work anymore, and then I'll make a new friend. But hopefully it's not a bottle of Southern Comfort. All right. Okay, next page. There are always going on the wagon for keeps. We're all familiar with this type, going on the wagon for keeps. They are ever remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. We don't make a decision to do the steps, to go through with it. And that is power. Making that decision to go through with it, to commit to it, that for me was taking my power back. There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking, changes his brand, his environment. I did the same thing. I did not find that I could stop until I listened to the people, places, and things. People, places, and things were huge for me. I had almost 90 days sober at one time, and I went down the shore, and I was around a whole bunch of people who were drinking, and I wound up drunk. I was with the wrong people, I was in the wrong place, and I was doing the wrong things. You know, and that just proved to me that people, places, and things were huge. Until I was in fit spiritual condition, I couldn't be with those people, I couldn't go to those places, and I couldn't do those things. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They're talking about, you know, what kind of drinker. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. So I can't just have a little bit we can't have just a little bit, because to have a little bit is, for me, to have a little bit is to die. You know, I've heard many people say, you know, I probably have another drunk in me. I probably have two, but I definitely don't have another recovery in me. I was sick. I was sick. And I know that I would be really, really blessed if I was to make it back into these rooms, if I went back out again. Really, really lucky. I'm not willing to roll those dice again. I just can't. This program has given me way too much to roll those dice. Oh, okay. So I'm almost done, I promise. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. And that was definitely me. I saw it for all of you, but I did not see it for me. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. So he had a willingness to accept something different. And it took a little bit of time for me to accept something different, because this definitely was something different for me. It was about getting comfortable with everything uncomfortable. Going to a woman's meeting, I didn't want to have anything to do with women. You know, going to, you know, when I first started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I think my husband was in jail at the time. And, you know, he was detoxing in jail. And I remember going to Mountainside. I was driving a very old beat-up Honda Accord, and I had a pint of Southern Comfort in the trunk. And I was like, okay, let me just go into the meeting, not drink anything, go into the meeting, and then I'll just have some when I come out. And that continued on for a little while. And then I didn't buy one before I went to the meeting. And I bought one on the way home. And that happened for a little while. And then I didn't buy one at all. God bless.
Bless you.
And then I didn't buy one at all. And I started to accept some of the things that this woman was telling me. She was the only woman at the Mountainside meeting, and she became my sponsor. And she told me that everything that I was feeling was okay. Because I felt ashamed. Here my husband is in jail. He can't drink, and I'm sitting here getting drunk. I'm feeling scared about what's going to happen to me, what's going to happen to my marriage, what's going to happen to my home, am I going to lose it, what's going to happen to my job. It's okay. It's okay to be afraid. But she's like, if you just keep doing the next right thing, it's going to be okay. I promise you, it's going to be okay. And she kept telling me that feelings are not facts. These things will pass. You know, I hated that saying, this too shall pass, because I didn't believe it, you know. And I didn't believe that there was any hope for me. And then I started to see other people changing, and I thought, you know, maybe there is something here for me. Maybe I'll stick around. Okay, I'm going to finish this up. So 1 year later, he called to see me. I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. He was a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck, had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. So he came back to see him later after he got sober. And he barely recognized him. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. So this man got sober, and he, you know, the doctor was like, it was like I never knew him before. He's just a totally changed man. And I will tell you that if you are new to this program, you will be changed by it. And always for the better. Always for the better. I've never seen anybody come in here and not be changed for the better, even if they go back out. It's up here. It's in here. You know, you can't forget it. So, last page. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He had not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. Mm-hmm. And I just love that chapter. Taking all these old ideas, replacing them with new ones, and the fact that a doctor stepped up to the plate and said, this is working. Whatever we're doing, we can take it so far, but that's it. That's as far as we can take it. Then it's up to these people, because they know. They can relate, you know. I can talk to a doctor about how I feel till I'm blue in the face, but he's not going to get it the way another alcoholic does. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Tracy. Hi, Lisa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Lisa.
Yeah, I can totally relate to what she just said when it comes down to, like, going to doctors. Like, I knew there was something wrong, but I had no clue I was an alcoholic. So I would go to doctors. I don't know what's wrong with me. I would go to psychologists, psychiatrists. I would try everything, but I just wasn't being honest with myself. And basically, that's what this program is about, like, getting honest and really honest. So I'm going to go touch upon Bill's story. I actually love this chapter myself. I didn't in the beginning, that's for sure. I didn't get it. I was like, what the hell is this guy talking about? But as time goes on and the more and more I read it, which I've read it so many times with sponsees and just on my own, every time I read it, something else pops out at me. So I was reading it, of course, today because, you know, I do everything last minute. Because I'm a good alcoholic. But, you know, I was going through it and I was like, wow, you know, I didn't think I had so much in common with Bill, but I do. I really, really do. When you take what he's saying here, he's kind of breaking it down and showing, like, the progression, you know, we all, what's going on inside of us before we even take the drink, you know. Here it says in that first paragraph, here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last. And in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. So right there, I was part of life at last. Like, that shows me right there, he wanted to be a part of. So that was me. Like, growing up, I never felt that I was a part of anything. I felt like I was always reaching for, I was always trying to make you impressed with me. I always was trying to fit in. So whatever you liked, I liked. Whatever you did, I did. You like rock music, I like rock music, you know. I just wanted you to like me. I wanted to be a part of. So that right there in that first paragraph is like, okay, I get it, you know. And I didn't get that before. These were just words on a page. But the more clear I get, the more I understand that this is really so intertwining in my life. Let's see. So he's actually speaking of his life and how he wants to better himself. So he goes and on to try to become this type of leader in, like, law. And then he finds out that his passion is finance. So with that, it's like I can see that it's like the power. He's searching for that power because he's looking outside of himself to feel good. And I did that myself. I did that in relationships. I did that, you know, with my parents. You know, I felt so empty inside. I needed you to validate my worth. I had zero worth. And, you know, if I could make you proud of me, maybe, you know, and make you think that I'm this great person, maybe I'll feel good. Maybe that'll make me feel good. But it really never did. It was always very temporary. You know, I would wind up trying to do the things that would make you happy, and I would go to any length necessary to make you happy. However, I was empty, and no matter what I did, I was empty. As Bill goes through life with this whole like course of action, you know, trying to find himself in his career, he finds alcohol. And alcohol, like in the beginning, it was like, okay, he was partying, he was having a good time, just like me. I was partying, having a good time. Alcohol was introduced to me. I didn't like the way it tasted, but I loved the way it made me feel. Like I felt it took me away from myself. I was funnier, I was prettier, I could dance, you know, I was smart, you know, like, and I just felt comfortable. But then it would go away. It would go away, and I was still left with myself. I wasn't a constant drinker, and I also had read that in here, that it wasn't constant in the beginning with Bill. However, I knew, like, I couldn't wait for the next one, you know? But as a young girl, I could not, like, go to the liquor store, let's face it. So I would do other things to feel good. You know, I would steal my mom's diet pills because I just want it to feel different, because her diet pills would give me that like euphoric buzz, and I never really knew like what that was. I didn't know why it felt so good, but then I did realize now that I'm in the program, like, yeah, you were messed up, girl. So when he said in this, on page 3, for the next few years, fortune through money and applause my way, I had arrived. I have had that feeling so many different times when it's come to my alcoholism. I just felt on top of the world when I wasn't Lisa, you know, because I would drink and I would become someone else, you know. I would become, you know, I have a profession where I'm around a lot of men, and they all drink and party, and I felt like one of the guys when I drank. You know, I fit in, and I had arrived. Like, I belong here. And I can see that that's where Bill starts to fit in with this crew. But then something happens, and something shifts. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. And there goes the isolation. I was a big isolator at the end. In the beginning of my drinking, no. I wanted to be around people. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be a part of. At the end of my drinking is when the isolation kicked in, and I was sitting on my couch day in and day out, just drinking myself to death and not going to work, coming up with excuses why I couldn't go to work. I faked a disease. I faked a disease and told them I had lupus. I can't come to work today. No, I had a hangover, and that's why I couldn't go to work. It was terrible. And I apologize if anybody has lupus. So, yeah, I do know that feeling of isolation and losing friends, losing family members. I was a liar, a cheat. I stole. I drove drunk. I just did so many things that I am so ashamed of. And so at the end, I was like, well, I live alone. Let me just drink. And honestly, at the very end, I didn't care about life anymore. I wanted to die. And thank God that didn't happen. I chose the rooms instead. I chose life. And it's only because my dad is actually a recovering alcoholic. And he's sober 35 years. So with his 35 years of sobriety, that seed, as Tracy was saying, was planted in my mind as a little girl. I used to sit in AA rooms in the rooms of AA, and I used to just listen and go to celebration meetings and be there when my dad got his coin and everything. So I did know about AA. I just didn't think I belonged in AA. Because my dad and my brother are both addicts. They're not alcoholics. They're addicts. They're both addicted to, narcotics, where I'm the alcoholic and I was addicted to alcohol. But let's face it, it's an addiction. I'm addicted to everything that makes me feel good. Food, shopping, men, whatever the case may be, anything that takes me outside of myself or anything that brings me comfort and joy, I want more of. Too bad it's not exercise, because that would be awesome, At the bottom here, I began to be jittery in the morning, and I know that feeling too. It's a terrible feeling. I'm sure you can all relate. I remember a time I was getting an award at work. And it was a prestigious award. It was Officer of the Year. And my whole family came, and I had a bender the night before, because of course I was celebrating. And I woke up in the morning, and I was shaking. I had nothing left. And because I was hungover, I woke up a little late, so I had zero time to, get anything, and nothing was open. So I'm at the podium getting my plaque, and I'm reading because I wrote something, and my hands are shaking like a leaf, and I couldn't get them to stop, and the sweat is just pouring down, and I just wanted to die right there. I was like, why am I doing, why would I do this to myself? And at that moment, here I'm getting this beautiful award, and I hated myself so bad because I just hated the person I became, My family was like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, I don't know. I didn't eat anything. Maybe my sugar's low. I always had an answer, It was never, of course. So as far as, let me see what I wrote here. Okay, on page 5, Bill goes to say that things gradually get worse. So he's starting to cross over from the treat of alcoholism to the need for alcoholism. For alcohol, I should say. I'm sorry. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. And there is where that progression happens. And it changes from being something that I enjoy to something I need. Mm-hmm. And I needed it every single day. I would try, changing it up, going from, vodka to wine. Or I really didn't like beer. But then I heard that scotch had lower carbs, the lowest amount of carbs. So I was like, okay, bring on scotch. And I used to drink scotch like a maniac. And that really pushed me over the edge. So here, where his progression starts, his life starts to get worse. He starts to see the consequences that are happening because of alcohol. And I realized that probably my last car wreck, I actually wrecked 3 cars, totaled them in a matter of 5 years. I drove drunk every day. Every day, it didn't matter. In blackouts, I rammed my car into a stopped truck, and the front of my car was just pushed in, and I walked away without a scratch. I was lucky. I was so lucky. That's God. If that isn't God, I don't know what that is, because I should not be here. You know, I should either be in jail or dead. It's so disgusting. Every time I think about it, I'm like, wow, you know, how did I do that? How could I get behind the wheel of a car? Like, what if a woman was wheeling her baby down the street and with the baby carriage, and I, you know, here I am drinking and driving. I went right under a tow truck. Like, there was a flatbed tow truck that was parked on the side of a road, and in my drunken stupor, texting, you know, like fighting with my boyfriend at the time, you're a jerk, and going right under the tow truck. And the flatbed of the tow truck is in my car. And then I back out and I continue my way and I go and have dinner and drinks with a friend, crying that I you know, what I just did, leaving the scene of an accident. And it was just disgusting. What if that was a baby, a mother wheeling her baby? What if that was somebody on a bike? You know, like, what if that was somebody, some kids walking home from school? You know, I could have killed them. I'm so glad I don't have to live like that anymore. My gosh. So, continuing on, the hopelessness that Bill starts to feel, you know, and seeing the look in his wife's face, you know, when Lois is, you know, he's trying to, he says that he is trying to, you know, make her happy. So here he's saying that he wants to get sober, but he doesn't want to drink because of her, you know, and I've done that as well. You know, I'm in a relationship and, well, I was in a relationship and, you know, maybe if you stop drinking so much, maybe you'll be a better person. Maybe our relationship will work. But I didn't believe that. It was always your fault. You know, it's not my fault. Just get off my back. I want to drink. Bill was seriously ill, bodily and mentally. And I can totally say that I, too, was seriously ill, bodily and mentally. My way of thinking was really, really sick. And, you know, I, too, made a small problem into a very large problem all the time. You know, if people were talking in a corner and I was in the room, they were talking about me. I was envious and jealous and angry. I was constantly having fist fights with people. I would fight with my brother until we were like in our 30s. That's disgusting. My parents, like on Thanksgiving, my brother and I are like fighting, like fist fighting, in my 30s. So the cops had to come, and it was just horrible living like that, you know. Now I can go to my family's house and have a really nice time, and now they want me there, and, you know, holidays are nice, but it was never ever like that. As a kid, it wasn't like that, and as an adult, it wasn't like that. But now, this program has given me a life back that I can go to holidays and not have fist fights with my brother. let's see. Okay, so page 8. This is where I saw what he was writing about his wife. I thought of my poor wife. So there. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. And yeah, I know self-pity all too well. And I still, to this day, go through that. Self-pity is one of the things that I usually go to on, you know, whenever something occurs in my life, self-pity is the first thing I go to. Woe is me, you know. But now I have the tools necessary to get past that. You know, I wallow in my crap for a little while. I give myself that. And then, okay, what am I going to do to get out of this? You know, I need to feel better. So I pick up the phone, I call my girls, I get to a meeting, I pray. I should pray first, but I don't usually do that. I don't know why. That's something I have to work on. But there's answers today. There's solutions. I don't have to go to the bottle for a solution anymore. Thank God. In this one paragraph, down at the bottom, because now he's starting to feel all the effects of his consequences. And he's starting to realize just how powerless he is and how much his life is a mess. Alcohol was his master. And right there, I have that like highlighted, underlined, and next to it I wrote surrender. So that's when he first realizes, you know, I can't do this anymore. I can't live like this anymore. And my surrender was sitting in my living room with a loaded gun in my mouth. That was my surrender. Looking at my son's picture on the wall and choosing to live instead of blowing my brains out, because it would have been easier to pull that trigger than to get sober. I didn't want to get sober because how can I live with myself? How could I live without booze? And I, you know, that was my comfort, and until it wasn't anymore. And but that was the moment I surrendered and said, I can't live like this anymore. At the end of this paragraph, my musing was interrupted by the telephone, and thank God he answered that phone. What would have happened to us if he did not answer that phone? Like, don't I think about that, and it's wild to me. You know, if he didn't answer that phone, there wouldn't have been AA, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the journey that started, because that was Abby Thatcher, who is a friend of his. And he comes to his home, and he's sitting there, and he looks wonderful, and he's, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and he starts, like, telling him that, you know, I'm sober, and this and that, and Bill's like, oh, good, more for me, you know, because he puts out his alcohol, and he puts out two glasses, and Abby's like, no, I don't drink. And Bill's like, okay, well, there you go, more for me. So I am so grateful that he answered that phone and that he went through the that's pretty much step 12. Let's face it, you know, you're speaking the word, you're delivering the message that is so freely given to you, you know, and you're passing it on. And I have been it's probably one of my favorite things about AA, because I'm a giver. I love to give. And to give someone the gift of, or like give them that little seed in their mind to make them realize, you know, there's more to life than drinking. You know, you can do this. And when they start to listen and realize that life is so much better without alcohol, and I see the change in them, there's nothing better than that. And honestly, it's beautiful. So I don't want to, like, not get into the God story, because I know we're getting to that time. But, like, when Bill finds God, he has that white light experience. I did not have that, like Tracy. Mine was kind of like fake it till you make it in the beginning. I didn't, you know, I grew up with a punishing God. Grew up Catholic. You know, if I did wrong, you know, you sin, you go to hell. And I felt like God was punishing me throughout my life because I wasn't a good person. So I didn't want to believe in God. God to me was not who I wanted to talk to, because he was mean. So like, you know, coming into the rooms, I wanted to just believe whatever you believed in. You know, like if you tell me there's a God, okay, there must be a God because you're staying sober, you know? So that's exactly what I did. I just followed exactly what everyone else did, because I'm really good at that. God had done for him what he could not do for himself. And that is something that is so prevalent in my life today, because I was in a very toxic relationship for a long time, 11 years, and God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and He removed that person from my life forever. And that is, I wouldn't have done it. That's God. Because I totally, if I do it my way, it's always the wrong way, let's face it. So I definitely, definitely know that that sentence right there is so true for me. God had done for him what he could not do for himself. And with that, I think I'm going to stop, and we'll continue next week. Thank you.